Welcome to our deep dive on the Book of Exodus. We've got some fascinating excerpts from lectures by Dr. Ted Hildebrandt, a scholar who really brings this ancient history to life.
It's going to be quite a journey, exploring everything from the meaning of names to those powerful themes that just echo throughout the Bible.
Okay, so let's dive right in. First, let's set the stage. Exodus. It's about escape, right? But what's the deeper meaning of that escape? And why is it such a pivotal moment in the Old Testament?
You've hit the nail on the head. Exodus literally means the way out, the Israelites' journey out of slavery in Egypt. Mm. But think about it. This isn't just a physical escape. It's a spiritual liberation. It becomes a blueprint for redemption that resonates throughout the entire Bible.
So it's almost like this one event, it sets the tone for how we understand God's interaction with humanity.
Exactly. Think about the format. Moses never saw a bound book in his life. What we call the Book of Exodus was originally a scroll, making the Book of the Covenant, more accurately, a scroll of the covenant. It changes how you envision those words being passed down, doesn't it?
It really does. You know, it's amazing how even something as simple as the format can shift our perspective. But let's get back to the content. What are the key events that make up this grand story of Exodus?
Think of Exodus in five movements. First, we have the birth and call of Moses. He's the author of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. So he's a pre-major player. Then there's the showdown between God and Pharaoh with those 10 dramatic plagues that really showcase God's power over even the mightiest of rulers.
The plagues, they're always so, so fascinating and terrifying at the same time. Each one seems to be a, deliberate challenge to the Egyptian gods, right?
Precisely. It's a battle of power, of who you choose to fear, the visible might of Pharaoh or the unseen God. Then we have the dramatic escape across the Sea of Reeds. Yes, reeds. The Hebrew name makes that distinction. And it changes how we picture that crossing, doesn't it?
It does. You know, it wasn't the vast ocean we often imagine. This makes the parting of the waters even more intriguing. But their journey doesn't stop there, does it?
No. They then encounter the tabernacle. This portable tent where God dwells among his people. It represents their unique relationship and God's commitment to them. And finally, there's the receiving of the Torah, the law, at Mount Sinai, a moment that solidifies their covenant with God.
Five major movements, each one packed with layers of meaning and symbolism. But you mentioned that this idea of redemption, it echoes throughout the Bible. Can you elaborate on that?
Of course. If Jesus' death and resurrection are central to the New Testament, then the Exodus is the pivotal redemptive event of the Old Testament. Think of Hosea 11:1, where God calls Israel out of Egypt like a loving father calling his son. It's a beautiful image of deliverance, but then you see it juxtaposed with Israel's rebellion, almost like a child running away from that love.
It adds a layer of complexity to the relationship, a tension between God's faithfulness and humanity's tendency to stray.
Exactly. And it doesn't stop there. Even Jesus fulfills the out of Egypt I called my son prophecy in Matthew 2:15, directly connecting him to Israel's story.
Yeah.
It's fascinating how those connections appear throughout the Bible.
It's almost like like a hidden thread connecting these seemingly disparate events. It really makes you think about the interconnectedness of scripture.
And then there's Paul. He portrays Jesus as the Passover lamb, drawing a direct line from the Exodus symbolism of blood and sacrifice to Christ's ultimate sacrifice. Even the plagues in Revelation, they echo those in Exodus, linking final judgment with God's act of liberating his people.
So it's not just a single story. It's a recurring theme that that shapes our understanding of God's plan throughout history. But how did the Torah itself come to be? Was it always a written text?
That's where things get really interesting. In Exodus 17:14, God tells Moses to write down his words. But then in Exodus 24:4, Moses speaks to the people first. They agree, and then he writes it down. It's a fascinating back and forth.
That's a curious detail. Why the switch between oral and written? It seems almost intentional.
It likely served as a system of checks and balances, mm-hmm. ensuring accuracy in the transmission of God's word. Think of it; it's a powerful way to guarantee the integrity of the message.
It's like they had a built-in system for quality control long before any modern technology. But of course, there are those who question the authorship of the Torah, right? They try to separate the text from Moses.
That's a common tactic used to try and discredit the Bible. By disassociating the text from its author, they aim to diminish its historical credibility.
But wouldn't that apply to other other biblical figures as well, trying to separate David from the Psalms or Isaiah from his prophecies?
Exactly. But even Jesus himself affirms Moses as the giver of the law in John 7:19-22. He uses the examples of circumcision and the Sabbath, directly challenging those who dismiss Moses' role. It's quite a powerful counterargument.
It's almost like saying, if you question Moses, you're questioning me too. But let's shift gears a bit and talk about ancient Egypt. I think most people imagine it as this monolithic, powerful empire. But was it always like that?
Not at all. Ancient Egypt, known as the Gift of the Nile, wasn't always a dominant force. It had periods of strength and weakness, which played a surprisingly significant role in Israel's story.
So the Egypt that that the Israelites encountered wasn't necessarily the same Egypt that that built the pyramids, right?
Exactly. Imagine this. The Old Kingdom, the era of pyramid building, was already ancient history by the time of Abraham around 2000 BC. But between those powerful kingdoms, there were these intermediate periods, times of chaos and foreign influence. It's likely that that Abraham visited Egypt during one of those weaker periods.
So even the mighty Egypt had its vulnerabilities, its moments of instability.
And it's during one of those vulnerable periods, the second intermediate period, that the Israelites were enslaved in Egypt. This is when the Hyksos, a foreign group, gained control, leading to that Pharaoh who did not know Joseph. It explains the sudden shift in how the Israelites were treated.
That makes a lot of sense. It wasn't just random cruelty, but a consequence of political upheaval and a change in leadership.
Right. And then there's the New Kingdom, a time of expansion for Egypt. However, they were usually more focused on their own Nile-fed prosperity, not so much on conquering vast territories. It wasn't until the third intermediate period around the time of David and Solomon that Egypt's weakness allowed those kingdoms to flourish. It's fascinating how these historical cycles intertwined.
It really highlights how one nation's, internal struggles can have ripple effects on surrounding nations. But speaking of location, let's talk about Goshen, the region where the Israelites settled. It wasn't just any random piece of land, was it?
You're right to be curious about Goshen. It wasn't some random settlement. The Egyptians had strategic reasons for placing them there. For one, it acted as a buffer zone against invaders from the northeast, the most vulnerable direction for Egypt.
Ah, so they were essentially a human shield protecting Egypt from, potential threats.
And there's another layer to this. Remember, the Israelites were shepherds while Egyptians were farmers. Goshen, with its unsuitable land for farming, kept the two groups separate and protected the Egyptians' valuable crops. It was a way to control and contain them.
So it was strategic placement with a touch of prejudice thrown in. It's a sobering thought.
Indeed. But as their numbers grew, Pharaoh grew increasingly fearful. He implemented harsh measures like forced labor under brutal taskmasters, hoping to wear them down and limit their time for families.
It's hard to imagine the kind of suffering they endured under such oppression. But his cruelty didn't stop there, did it?
Tragically, no. He even ordered the Hebrew midwives, Shifra and Pua, to kill all newborn boys. It's a chilling example of gender-based discrimination that sadly still echoes in some parts of the world today.
It's a horrifying thought that, such practices still exist. But it's remarkable that we know the names of those midwives, while Pharaoh remains nameless. It's almost like the text itself is making a statement.
Exactly. Their names are etched in history for their bravery and defiance. They feared God more than Pharaoh and chose to protect innocent life. And they were clever, too. They told Pharaoh that the Hebrew women gave birth too quickly for them to intervene.
But that was a lie. Doesn't the Bible condemn lying? How do we reconcile that with their actions?
It's a challenging question, isn't it? The midwives were trapped in a horrifying dilemma, forced to choose between honesty and saving lives. It forces us to consider those difficult situations where the lines blur, where even a good action might require a compromise.
It makes you think about those impossible choices people face, even today, where there are no easy answers, like hiding refugees from persecution or using deception in war to protect innocent lives. It's a complex ethical landscape.
Precisely. And in the case of the midwives, their fear of God and their act of preserving life were ultimately blessed. But there's another layer of irony in this story, the Nile River itself.
The lifeblood of Egypt, the source of their prosperity. How does it factor into this story of oppression and deliverance?
Pharaoh used the Nile, a god to the Egyptians, to try to kill Israelite babies. Mm. But God, with a touch of poetic justice, uses that same river to deliver Moses right into the heart of Pharaoh's household.
That's a powerful image. It's almost like God is turning their own weapon against them, using their own belief system to orchestrate his plan. But can you remind us of how Moses ended up in the Pharaoh's household?
Picture this: baby Moses placed in a tar-coated basket, set adrift on the very river Pharaoh intended to use for death. He's discovered by Pharaoh's own daughter, who, recognizing him as a Hebrew child, chooses to adopt him. It's a twist of fate that you couldn't script.
It's intriguing that she recognized him as a Hebrew child. Was it his clothing? Or perhaps a circumcision?
The text leaves that detail a mystery. There's another amazing detail. Moses' sister Miriam, pretending to be a helpful bystander, orchestrates his upbringing, ensuring he's exposed to both Hebrew and Egyptian ways. It's a subtle but significant detail.
It's almost like she's subtly shaping his destiny, preparing him for the role he's going to play. And speaking of destiny, Moses' life unfolds in these fascinating stages, doesn't it?
It does. His first 40 years are spent in his Hebrew family, then in the luxury of Pharaoh's court. He becomes highly educated, familiar with both worlds. Then a dramatic shift, 40 years as a shepherd in Midian. It sounds idyllic, but shepherding life in the desert was likely harsh, lonely, a time of introspection.
It's quite a contrast to the opulence of the palace. It almost feels like a deliberate stripping away of his Egyptian identity, a preparation for something greater.
And of course, those final 40 years leading the sheep of Israel out of Egypt and through the wilderness, it's a beautiful parallel between his earlier experience and this new immense responsibility, shepherding on a grand scale.
It's almost, poetic how his life experiences prepared him for this monumental task. But before he takes on that role, there's a powerful moment in Exodus 3.7 where God says he's rescuing the Israelites because he heard their cries. Mm. It really emphasizes the power of prayer, doesn't it?
It does. It reminds us that our prayers, even in the darkest of times, reach God and move him to action. But even with this divine motivation, Moses, one of the Bible's greatest heroes, initially resists God's call.
Really? You'd think he would have, jumped at the chance to liberate his people. What were his hesitations?
His initial response is so human, so relatable. He asks, "Who am I?" He feels inadequate, lacking authority. God's response is simple but profound. "I will be with you." That concept of Emmanuel, God with us, is central to the entire story.
It's a powerful reminder that our qualifications aren't the point. God's presence is what matters. His empowerment is what makes the difference.
But Moses' doubts don't end there.
Yeah.
He asks, "What is your name?" It's not just a casual question. It's desire for deeper knowledge, a need to understand the one who's calling him.
It's like he needs that foundation of understanding, of knowing who he's dealing with before he can fully commit. And God answers him, doesn't he?
He does. And it's a game changer. God reveals his sacred name, Yahweh I Am, WHOIM. It's a declaration of self-existence, of unchanging nature, of absolute being.
Wow, it's hard to wrap your head around the depth of that revelation. It's like a glimpse into the very essence of God. But even after all that, Moses still hesitates. He doubts his ability to convince the Israelites.
And that's when God provides those tangible signs, those visual demonstrations of power. The staff turning into a snake, his hand becoming leprous and then healed. It's a message of, I've got your back, just trust me.
But it still wasn't enough, was it?
No. Moses then claims, I am slow of speech and tongue.
Yeah.
He doubts his ability to communicate effectively. And God's response is both humorous and reassuring.
How so? I'm curious to hear how God addresses this insecurity.
He essentially says, who made your mouth? I did. And if I can make a donkey talk, I can certainly help you communicate. It's a gentle reminder that he's in control. That he equips those he calls.
It's almost like he's saying, stop focusing on your limitations and trust my ability to work through you.
Exactly. In the end, God appoints Aaron as Moses' spokesperson, acknowledging his concern while still calling him to step into leadership. It establishes that pattern of God speaking through prophets, which we see throughout the Bible.
It's fascinating how God works with our individual strengths and weaknesses. He doesn't force us into roles we're not suited for, but provides the support we need to fulfill his purpose. But let's talk about the name Yahweh. What does it mean? What's the significance of that revelation?
There are a few different interpretations of the I am, WHO, I am. Some believe it emphasizes God's self-existence, meaning he needs nothing outside himself. Others see it as I will be what I will be, suggesting God will reveal himself through his actions. And yet another interpretation is I am what I said I would be, emphasizing God's faithfulness as a covenant keeper.
It's amazing how much depth and meaning is packed into that one name. It's a foundation for understanding God's character and his interaction with humanity. But there's a curious detail that seems to contradict this revelation, doesn't it?
You're right. Exodus 6.3 states that the patriarchs didn't know God as Yahweh. Yet in Genesis 49.8, Jacob uses the name Yahweh. It seems like a contradiction.
Wait, hold on. How can those two statements both be true? Isn't that a problem?
And here's a cliffhanger for you. Every time you see Lord in all caps in English translations, that's standing in for the Hebrew name Yahweh. It adds a whole new dimension to the text, doesn't it?
It really does. So is there a translation issue, or is there a deeper meaning we're missing here? This is definitely something to ponder. Okay, so last time we left off with that intriguing mystery surrounding God's name Yahweh. It's in Genesis, but then Exodus is the patriarchs didn't know God by that name. It's like a puzzle.
It is a puzzle, but yeah. But it points to something crucial about how God reveals himself. Think of it like getting to know a person.
Mm.
You start with their name, maybe what they do, but the more time you spend together, the more you understand their heart, their values.
So you're saying God was gradually revealing different aspects of himself through history.
Exactly. The patriarchs knew him as El Shaddai, God Almighty. But the deeper revelation of Yahweh, his covenant faithfulness, his personal presence that comes later as the relationship deepens.
It's like those layers of meaning we talked about, like with the scroll of the covenant, there's always more to discover. But back to Moses. He's still wrestling with taking on this mission.
And his reluctance makes him even more compelling, don't you think? It shows even the most faithful can be scared, doubtful when God calls them to something extraordinary.
It definitely makes him more relatable. I mean, who am I is a question we all ask ourselves when faced with a big challenge. But I love how God responds to that.
It's not a list of qualifications, is it?
Oh, God.
Like pep talk. Just, I will be with you. That's the core of it. God's presence is the source of strength, not our own ability.
It really shifts the focus, doesn't it? It's not about what we can do, but about allowing God to work through us. But then Moses asks about God's name. It's more than just wanting to know, right?
Absolutely. He's seeking understanding, that deeper knowledge that that builds trust. And the name Yahweh, I am, WHO, I am, it speaks to God's unchanging nature, his faithfulness to his promises.
It's almost like that name becomes the foundation for everything that that follows. It's the bedrock of their relationship. But even then, Moses still worries about whether the Israelites will believe him.
And God provides those incredible signs, the staff becoming a snake, the hand with leprosy that's then healed. Tangible proof, undeniable power.
It's like God saying, look, I can back up my words. Don't worry about convincing them. Just be my messenger.
There's one more hurdle. Moses says he's not a good speaker. And honestly, that's where I find myself relating to him the most. Public speaking isn't exactly my strength either.
I hear that. But God has a rather creative response to that one, doesn't he?
Who made your mouth? Yes. It's almost playful. But the point is, clear God is the ultimate communicator. Hmm. If he can make a donkey talk, surely he can equip Moses to speak to his people.
It's a reminder that God can use anyone, regardless of their perceived weaknesses, to accomplish his purposes. So in the end, God appoints Aaron as Moses' spokesperson, a solution that acknowledges Moses' concern but still pushes him into that leadership role.
It establishes this pattern of God working through prophets, which becomes a major theme throughout the Old Testament. But things are about to get very real, very dramatic as Moses returns to Egypt.
The plagues, I mean, they're so iconic, almost cinematic in their scope. But what's the deeper meaning behind them? It's not just about God showing off his power, is it?
Each plague is a deliberate challenge to a specific Egyptian god, a demonstration that Yahweh is the one true God. It starts with the Nile turning to blood, their life source, their god corrupted.
Imagine the terror, the sense of everything they believed in being shaken. It's a powerful image. And then I remember the frogs.
Swarms of them invading their homes, their beds.
Right.
A creature they associated with fertility and life becomes a horrifying nuisance.
Ugh. It's one thing to read about it, but to actually experience that, the stench, the sheer number of them. But it doesn't stop there, right?
No, it escalates. Plague after plague, gnats and lice infesting everything.
Yeah.
A reminder that even the smallest creatures are under God's control, then flies bringing disease and disrupting their daily lives, each one targeting something they held sacred, something they relied on.
And then it gets even more intense, doesn't it? It moves beyond just discomfort to actual devastation.
The fifth plague, their livestock, their livelihood struck down, then painful boils afflicting both people and animals, a direct challenge to their God of healing. It's relentless.
It feels like a systematic dismantling of their entire worldview, everything they thought they understood about power and the divine.
And the natural world becomes a weapon as well. Devastating hail locusts devouring their crops, darkness covering the land for days. A stark contrast to their sun god, Wrath.
It's like God is stripping away everything they depended on, everything they thought gave them security.
And then the final plague, the most devastating of all, the death of the firstborn.
That one is always so hard to grapple with. The grief, the sheer scale of the loss. It's almost too much to bear.
This one strikes at the very heart of Pharaoh's power. He's seen as a divine ruler, an embodiment of Horus, but God demonstrates his authority over even the mightiest of kings.
It's a sobering reminder that no one, no matter how powerful, is beyond the reach of God's judgment. But the Israelites, they were protected, weren't they?
God provided a way out, the Passover, the blood of the lamb, a symbol of sacrifice and protection, marking their door so the angel of death would pass over them.
It's a powerful image of God's grace amidst judgment, his faithfulness to his promises. And finally, after all that, Pharaoh relents, lets the Israelites go.
But his stubbornness isn't quite broken. He quickly changes his mind, sets out with his army to recapture them. It leads to that iconic confrontation at the Sea of Reeds.
You keep saying Sea of Reeds, and I'm curious, why not just call it the Red Sea? That's what I've always heard it called.
It's the actual Hebrew term from the Bible, Yam Suf, Sea of Reeds.
Yeah.
We're not sure which body of water it refers to specifically, but it was likely shallower, marshier than the Red Sea we picture today.
So not that vast, imposing ocean that makes their escape seem almost impossible.
Exactly. Imagine being trapped between Pharaoh's army and this seemingly impassable sea of reads. It highlights the utter desperation of their situation and makes God's intervention even more dramatic.
The parting of the waters. I can't imagine witnessing that, the sheer power of it, the visual spectacle.
It's a testament to God's power, his faithfulness to his people. He literally makes a way where there seems to be no way. And when the Egyptians tried to follow the waters close back in ending their pursuit once and for all.
What a powerful bending to that chapter. But that crossing, it wasn't just a physical escape, was it?
No, it symbolizes their liberation from slavery. The start of their journey to the promised land, it becomes a metaphor for God's ability to deliver us from any situation, no matter how hopeless it may seem.
It's a message that resonates throughout history, doesn't it? The idea that even when we feel trapped, God can make a way.
But their journey doesn't end there. Does it? I mean, the promised land is still a long way off.
They're heading towards freedom, but it's not a straight path. They got a long, challenging trek through the wilderness ahead of them. And that's where we'll pick up next time. Okay, so we've got escape, we've got miracles, we've got the mystery of God's name. I can't wait to see what happens next on this journey. Welcome back to our deep dive into Exodus. We've seen those incredible plagues, the escape through the Sea of Reeds. It's been quite a journey so far.
And it's not over yet. Remember, reaching the promised land is still a long way off. The wilderness awaits, and that's where things get really interesting.
So it's not just smooth sailing from here on out. I imagine escaping Egypt was just the first hurdle, right?
Precisely. The wilderness is a time of testing of refinement for the Israelites. They face hunger, thirst, attacks from enemies, all those challenges that that force them to rely on God.
It's almost like a crucible, a place where their faith is forged in the fires of hardship.
Exactly. But it's also a time of immense spiritual growth, of God revealing himself in new and profound ways. Think of it like this. They're leaving behind a life of slavery, of being defined by their oppressors. And now they're learning what it means to be God's chosen people.
That's a huge shift in identity. But they need some guidance for that, right? I mean, how do you go from being slaves to being a nation built on a covenant with God?
That's where the giving of the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai comes in. It's a pivotal moment, establishing the foundation for their relationship with God, outlining the moral and ethical framework for their lives.
Those commandments are so ingrained in our culture even today. It's fascinating to think about them being given in that dramatic setting amidst thunder and lightning.
It's a powerful image. But remember, the Ten Commandments are just part of a larger body of law, the Torah. It covers everything from worship and sacrifice to social justice, even personal hygiene, a blueprint for every aspect of their lives.
Wow. It's a lot more comprehensive than I realized. It really underscores the fact that this wasn't just about escaping Egypt. It was about building a new society, a new way of life.
Exactly. They needed a clear framework to transition from slaves to a nation governed by God's law.
Right.
It's a radical transformation.
But let's be honest, they weren't always great at following those laws, were they? I mean, those stories of grumbling, complaining, even turning to idol worship.
You're right. Their journey is marked by this constant tension between obedience and rebellion. They're human, just like us, struggling with temptation, doubt, and the challenges of living out their faith.
It's a reminder that even with the best intentions, even with God's guidance, it's not always easy to stay on the right path.
But even in their failures, God remains faithful. He doesn't abandon them. He continues to guide them, to provide for them, to offer second chances.
That's a comforting thought. It reminds us that God's grace is bigger than our mistakes, that he's always there to pick us up when we fall. But speaking of tangible signs of God's presence, what about the tabernacle? It's such a unique structure, a portable sanctuary.
The tabernacle is a visual representation of God's dwelling among his people. It's a symbol of his covenant with them, a place of worship, sacrifice, and seeking his guidance.
I've always been fascinated by the detailed descriptions of its construction, all those intricate layers and materials. It seems like every element had a deeper meaning.
Absolutely.
Hmm.
Those specific instructions, the precise measurements, highlight the importance of holiness, of order in their relationship with God. It's not just about throwing something together. It's about creating a space that reflects the sacredness of his presence.
It's almost like God saying, I want to be near you, but there needs to be a reverence, a recognition of my holiness.
Exactly. And think about this. It was a portable structure, a reminder that God was with them on their journey through all the challenges and triumphs. It was a source of comfort, of stability amidst the uncertainty of the wilderness.
It's a beautiful image, a tangible expression of God's faithfulness and presence, but it wasn't meant to be permanent, was it?
No, and this is where it gets really interesting. The tabernacle foreshadows the ultimate dwelling place of God, not a physical structure, but the hearts of his people.
Wow, that adds a whole new layer of meaning. So the tabernacle points to a deeper reality, a spiritual dwelling that transcends physical limitations.
Exactly. And in the New Testament, we see this fulfilled through Jesus Christ. His sacrifice opens the way for God's presence to dwell within us through the Holy Spirit. It's the ultimate fulfillment of the tabernacle imagery.
So it's not just an ancient ritual. It's a story that connects to our own lives, our own relationship with God. It's amazing how those threads run through the entire Bible.
And that's the beauty of Exodus. It's not just a historical account. It's a loving story filled with timeless truths that continue to speak to us today.
What are some of those truths that we can take away from this deep dive into Exodus?
First and foremost, it reminds us that God is a God of deliverance. He frees his people from slavery. Whether it's physical bondage, addiction, fear, anything that holds us captive, there's always hope for liberation.
It's a powerful message of hope, a reminder that no matter how stuck we feel, God can make a way out. But freedom comes with responsibility, right? I mean, the Israelites weren't just set free to do whatever they wanted.
You're right. Exodus also highlights the importance of covenant and obedience. God's blessings are tied to their faithfulness and their rebellion as consequences. It's not about earning God's favor, but about living in alignment with his will, honoring the relationship he's established.
So true freedom isn't about doing whatever we want, but about choosing to live in a way that reflects God's character, that deepens our connection with him.
And finally, Exodus underscores the importance of God's presence in our lives. The tabernacle was that visual reminder, but today we have the incredible privilege of experiencing God's presence within us through the Holy Spirit.
It's like that ancient story has come full circle, from a physical dwelling to a spiritual reality that resides within each of us.
Absolutely. And that's the power of Exodus. It's a story that transcends time and culture, offering timeless truth that can transform our lives today.
This has been an incredible deep dive. I feel like I've gained a whole new appreciation for the book of Exodus and its relevance for us today.
It's been a joy exploring these profound themes with you. I encourage you to keep digging deeper into Exodus. There's always more to uncover.
And to our listener, we leave you with this. How is God calling you to step out in faith, to trust him, to make a way where there seems to be no way? How are you experiencing his presence in your life today? And what does it mean for you to live as a covenant people set apart for his purposes? Keep pondering, keep exploring. And until next time, keep diving deep.